The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, December 26, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, I hope you had a Merry Christmas yesterday or a Happy Hanukkah last night. We are on vacation. We are presenting our famous Best Of shows, wherein we present to you some of the... I mean, look, I don't know how you... How do you determine what's best? I don't know. They're not necessarily the sexiest. They're not necessarily the craziest. But they are important interviews that we want to get you out there, particularly in light of what we think is going to be big issues coming up in 2020. You know, things like healthcare and Medicaid. The ACA could be reversed. So today we bring you Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics with Jamila Mishner. She is a professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University. We did this interview back in January 28th of 2019. Enjoy this interview, and then we will give you some extra content. We're giving away the free half for free this year, for not the free half, the fun half for free to round out 2019. And hopefully you'll enjoy it and you'll say, hey, maybe I should become a member. I've been listening to this free show for months, weeks, years. Maybe it's time to become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com, wherein you can join the Majority Report and you get the show commercial free and you get extra content every week. So check that out. Also, AM Quickie, we're doing it this week. We didn't do it yesterday. I don't know if we're doing it today, but we'll definitely do it tomorrow. So check it out. If you haven't subscribed, amquickie.com, or you can just pick up the app, majorityapp.com, and the AM Quickie and the regular show is on that app, and it is for free. That's right. AM Quickie is for free. The app is for free. How can we afford to do this? I'm just really bad at business, and I don't know. And so the way I work these things out is I don't keep records. And so that way, I don't know if it's not working out. And that's the way I do that. So, and if you don't like it, I don't care. Quick break. Come back with Jamila Mishner. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Assistant Professor of Government from Cornell University, Jamila Mishner. She is the author of Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. Jamila, did I pronounce your last name correctly?
It's Mishner. So you were pretty close.
All right. Well, I apologize. Welcome to the program, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, all right, let's just start with, for folks who don't know, like, give us a sense of where Medicaid fits in as a program in the structure of government-sponsored health insurance.
Sure. So we don't have any sort of universal government-sponsored health insurance that anyone and everyone can have access to. Instead, what we have is the government helping various subsets of people who have very specific needs and fall into very specific categories. So we have Medicare, which is for elderly people who are over 65, so that you know you can get health insurance in your old age. And we have, for example, the VA, which is a government agency that provides health insurance and benefits to our veterans. And then we have Medicaid, which is a program that provides health insurance predominantly to low-income Americans, right? So people who are poor and lack resources. Now, that's not in every state. There are some states where you can be as poor as you like and you wouldn't get health insurance. But in many states, if you're at 133% of the poverty line or below, you can have access to Medicaid. And the vast majority of people who rely on Medicaid are living in poverty or very near poverty. And many of those people are also elderly. And so Medicaid covers what Medicare doesn't. And they are also disabled and have other kinds of health challenges. So Medicaid is the program that really provides health insurance for the most vulnerable, most needy people in the country.
And we should say, I mean, just to correct me if I'm wrong, but the VA is also not just provides health insurance, but they these are government paid doctors, essentially, and hospitals.
Yeah.
Okay. And so that is when people say government run health and health care, we have it. I mean, that is basically it. We just happen to only provide it to our vets. And and my understanding is too that the VA actually Elizabeth Warren came out with a proposal recently to produce generic drugs in certain instances by the government. The VA does that now when there are shortages. They're pretty much all in there. So let's start with this idea of how now Medicare is how is Medicare different from Medicaid? Well, I guess maybe I should ask that second. So let's talk about first about Medicaid and that fragmented nature. I don't think people realize how not federally directed Medicaid is. And I apologize for not for doing that like with a double negative, I guess. But explain
to
us if I'm eligible for Medicaid and go through a state where I may not even get, there may be no eligibility for me, through to a state where maybe they've accepted the expansion of Medicaid under the ACA. Where does the federal, direction end in terms of that flow of health insurance to a recipient?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the federal government sets the broadest kinds of contours for Medicaid as a health insurance provider, right? So there are some really large categories of things that every state who covers Medicaid beneficiaries, which is every state, has to provide, right? And there are certain categories of people that every state has to cover. And so, you know, pregnant women who are living below the poverty line can receive Medicaid in every state, right? And they can receive coverage for their pregnancy. However, what other things they receive coverage for might vary from state to state. So even if you're a pregnant woman who's eligible for Medicaid in any state, right? Let's say that you live in Alabama, you will get coverage for your pregnancy and for some things directly related to it, but you might not get physical therapy if you have an injury, and you might not get glasses if you're unable to see. You might not get your teeth taken care of if you have a dental problem, because those things, podiatry, vision, those are optional. And states can decide whether they want to offer those things to any of their Medicaid beneficiaries or whether they want to offer them to all of them. And they have lots and lots of leeway, of discretion. Now, there are some states that haven't expanded Medicaid. And in those non-expansion states, there are still 14 states that haven't adopted the expansion. And in those states, you can be very, very poor in many of those states and not qualify for Medicaid if, for example, you're a childless adult, or even if you're an adult with children in some cases. In the states that have expanded Medicaid, so the other 37 states, everyone who lives at 133 or below of the poverty line is eligible. But even in those states, whether you've expanded or not, states still get to make really specific choices about what they'll cover and what they'll not, that they won't. All states have to cover some basic suite of things. But then all states also have a ton more choice in terms of what they provide and what they don't.
Now, my understanding has always been that the reason why we would not want, from the perspective of someone who wants as many people as possible covered by health insurance, the reason why we would not want the federal government to block grant money to the states would be that the rate in which the increase of healthcare would not be covered, and that two, the state could use it, could redirect money. Like, what is the relationship between the money that the federal government makes available and the state? So when you say the state says, like, oh, we will not cover podiatry, for instance, are they getting the same amount of money per potential recipient as another state that may offer podiatry, and they just simply decide, oh, we're gonna put it on respiratory stuff as opposed to podiatry? I mean, how does that work? How does the money how does the state restrict in that fashion?
Yeah, so you know what Medicaid, in terms of the funding, you know, the federal government allocates or matches a certain amount of money, and it varies across states, and it depends on how much the states spend, and it also depends on the states themselves, for example, and how high poverty is in the states and a number of other factors. But the federal government essentially will cover, there's a kind of, it's called the Federal Medical Assistance Percentage, the FMAP multiplier, but it's the kind of the percentage that the federal government uses and determines that they will match and cover of all that the state spends. So, you know, states have to make decisions, because it is true that the more that they spend, the more that the federal government will cover for them. But then they're left covering the remaining percentage of the cost for Medicaid beneficiaries. So, the less they spend total, the less their leftover percentage is. And, you know, how much that percentage is varies from state to state. And so states have to make pretty complicated decisions about how much they can afford to spend and how much they're currently spending. You know, the thing about the real challenge with block grants is that, you know, states right now, you know, treat Medicaid as, and Medicaid is, it's really an entitlement. So states have a lot of decisions to make about who's eligible and who's not. But once they make decisions about who's eligible, every single person in that state who's eligible gets the benefit. And that's because no matter how much a state spends, the state can decide everybody's eligible below this certain amount. And right now that amount is 133. So even the states that have the most generous eligibility requirements, they decide we're going to be generous. The federal government will match that up until the place where they say they will, which is 133. And so those states can be really generous, and they can count on the federal government to match their share, to cover the share that they said that they will. And they have to cover the rest. But everyone in that state who qualifies based on those eligibility criteria will get Medicaid. That's what really an entitlement means. It doesn't mean anybody feels like they're entitled to anything. It just means everyone who fits the criteria gets the benefit. If we were to block grant Medicaid, states would have a capped amount, right? And that capped amount would increase over time, but it wouldn't increase at the rate of cost. And it would mean that when states ran out of money, when they ran out of the money that the federal government gave them, they ran out and there's no more money left. And so one of the things that happens under those circumstances is that people stop getting the benefit. It's not something that you get because you're eligible anymore. You get it if you're lucky enough to get it before the state runs out of the bundle of money that the federal government has given them. And so that often will mean that states have to pull back, that they have to offer less, that they have to cover fewer people. And then there's the big problem of right now, you know, states get compensated based on what they spent. But if states just get a fixed amount and it's given to them, right, there's an incentive there. Well, now we know that we're getting, you know, whatever the amount is, you know, we're getting $1 billion from the federal government. Let's try to find ways of spending less, right? Now we have a surplus and maybe we can do some other things with this. Maybe we can redirect it. We know that's what happened with TANF, with the temporary assistance for needy families when it got block granted. Now states just get a big old pile of money and they start getting creative about how they use that money. And they use less and less of it for the core purpose of the program. So that we know now states are using TANF funds to do all sorts of things, to fund scholarships, from college scholarships for middle class and upper middle class students. You know, they just make up reasons to spend the money on things that they want to, because block grants give them even more flexibility than they already have. Fewer resources to help people with, but more flexibility to misuse those resources.
Right. Okay. And so we should, in some respects, just to restate, in some ways right now, Medicaid is like an economic stabilizer, like food stamps. There is a formula as to who is eligible. And if you have, let's say, a financial crisis and more people lose their jobs and more people dip into poverty, more people are going to be eligible and the money will be there because the program will expand with the need, as opposed to the need being constrained by whatever we decide is an arbitrary number that we're going to fulfill that need with.
Yes.
Okay. And so
That's exactly right.
And then the block grants on top of that not only have that problem, but as you say, can easily be diverted by states that don't have an interest in providing for the least fortunate in their state. It's easy to pick out at least 14 right now that are almost openly hostile to those people based upon their refusal to pick up the expansion. But all right, so how is that different from as it is now, where you have a state that says, like, okay, we're going to take care of X number of our people, and we can't exactly say how many of those people there are, but we're going to set the formula at such a place where we anticipate it'll cover about X number of people, and the federal money will cover 80% of that, let's say, or 90% of that, and we'll have to make up that 10%. We can have that line item in the budget. It'll make it look like we're humane people on some respect. To some respect, how is Medicare different? Is Medicare is that parceled out by the state as well, or is that a direct federal benefit?
Medicare is a federal benefit. So with Medicaid, it's intergovernmental. The states are covering part, the federal government is covering part. And how much varies across states depending on several factors, but it really is a shared responsibility between the states and the federal government. Medicare is not a shared responsibility. The states do share some responsibility in terms of administering Medicare, right? So if you are an elderly person and you have a problem with your Medicare, there's a local office that you can go to talk to someone about it, and that's in your state. So states help with administration. But when it comes to where the funding for the program is coming from, it's coming from the center. It's coming from the federal government. And what that means is that, A, that it's more generous, B, that it's more reliable. It's much more difficult for Medicare to fluctuate, whereas with Medicaid, it goes up and down with state budgets. When states are having a hard time, when they're in some sort of an economic recession or having some sort of financial trouble, they can cut Medicaid. It's an option because there's a portion of it, a large chunk of it, that they're directly in control of. Medicare doesn't work like that. It's a much more stable and reliable program because its structure is nationally based and not federated in the same way that Medicaid is.
Okay. And your research, we started getting closer to like the heart of your research in terms of what that difference in that dynamic does to people's perspective on the program and in government more broadly. But lastly, how is it that what I mean, why is it that way? Like, why, when these two programs were developed, was there this distinction?
So this has been a part of the kind of broader struggle around providing people who have needs in the United States with what they need. You know, the way that we approach helping people, whether it's with their health needs or other core social needs in this country, has always been pretty piecemeal and fragmented. And so there are some groups of people that are viewed as desirable, and we want to help them, and we want to help them in ways that are generous, in ways that are consistent, in ways that are equitable and fair. And there are, and elderly people fall into that category, right? Who doesn't think of most elderly people as the kind of, you know, group that you want to help? Nobody wants to see old people sick or struggling or living in poverty. And so they're a sympathetic group that, you know, for a long time, American social policy has been oriented towards helping, and helping in the most stable, equitable way possible. Now, other groups of people, for example, people who are just poor, they may not be elderly, they may not be sympathetic in any other way, but they're poor, they lack resources. And our general policy approach in this country towards people who are living in poverty is that we want to give them, we tend to give them as little as possible, and we tend to have programs that help those people vary a lot across space. We want states to have a lot of choice, a lot of discretion over how they treat their poor people, right? And part of this is part of American political culture and the way that we think about people living in poverty and the kinds of policies that we make for them. But it's been baked into Medicaid from the very beginning. And so Medicaid and Medicare actually came from the very same piece of legislation. But the way that that legislation wrote the kind of policy, it set apart Medicare in one way and Medicaid in another. And that was largely a function of who the programs are serving, who their kind of targeted populations were. And when your targeted populations are people that we all feel good about and want to help, well, then you get policy that's more fair and consistent. And when your targeted populations are people that, you know, maybe some of us are suspicious of, we don't think they work hard enough, we don't want them using our taxpayer dollars, we don't want to sort of have them be supporting their quote-unquote dependency or whatever other tropes that we might have about people in need. When those are the targets of the policy, well, then we get very different policy. And that policy tends to not be as consistent or stable or generous.
How, and again, I'm sorry, we're a little bit tangential, but I think it's important because it really sets the table for people. But how racialized was that decision? Was it extremely racialized or just incredibly extremely racialized?
Whichever one is more, incredibly
yeah, right.
Extremely. I mean, you know, anyone who pays enough attention to U.S. social policy and the history of that policy knows that race is baked into all of these decisions, from the decision makers themselves and what state they came from and what their commitments were based on that, to the policies that were precursors to Medicaid. So before Medicaid emerged, there were lots of policies that were precursors to it that were sort of a beginning. There's a whole chapter in my book about the history of this. And, you know, over time, we're just trying newer and newer ways to target our benefits to the people who we like the most. And Black and brown people are almost never in that category, right? And even when they are in the category, we try to divert benefits away from them, even if they are elderly or they are veterans or they are pregnant women. And that's one of the things that the state flexibility gives us. It means that in places, for example, where
states' rights, right? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, that's basically the whole narrative. States' rights usually means, if not always, means how much are we allowed to discriminate against our people of color? Is really what it comes down to.
That is exactly right, and that's happened in all domains of social policy, including health policy, from the very beginning of the time that we had any policy. It's impossible even for me to tease out all of the kind of racial threads that can be woven when we think about Medicaid and health policy more generally. It's just ubiquitous. It's always there.
We've talked on this program a decent amount with folks who have written extensively on just the premise of Social Security also being highly racialized. And so, you know, 35 years later, I guess, when they're doing Medicare and Medicaid, it's, you know, what was old is new again and so on. In fact, also, I'm also struck that when we often talk about Medicaid and we talk about Medicaid cuts, the most salient political rhetoric is usually, or the one that gets the most traction, is often the statistic that 2/3 of our elderly who are in nursing homes are there because of Medicaid. So people spend, you know, as you get older, obviously you have less assets. You at one point run out of money and you must go into a nursing home. You become eligible for Medicaid. You get sort of like shuttled from Medicare to Medicaid, and then you're in a nursing home and Medicaid is paying for it. And
yeah,
that ends up being a big political talking point because, you know, of the way that we have a structure around the narrative around, I guess, the morality of being poor in this country. Or living in poverty, I should say. So, all right, well, let's talk about, too, the research that you've done. What are the implications from for this fragmentation on its recipient's perspective on government? Because one of the things that we also have heard is if you are on Medicaid, and one would think it would be different, but it's not, you are less likely to vote. Now, part of that is a function of poverty makes it harder to vote in many respects. But is there more to it than that?
Yes, there's more to it than that. So when I first started looking at some data, and initially it was quantitative data, it was survey data, and I saw this large pattern, Medicaid beneficiaries being less likely to vote. And it made perfect sense to me. These are folks who are living in poverty, and they're just, we know from lots of research, from decades of research, that they're less likely to participate in the political process because there are all sorts of barriers. And so I wasn't terribly surprised about that. But there was a part of me that also wanted to know, does Medicaid itself have anything to do with it? Is it about the nature and the characteristics of the people who are on Medicaid, things like poverty, or is there more to it? And what I found was that there was more to it. And I found that by looking deeper into quantitative data, into survey data, and thinking about how to control for things like poverty and lots of the things that we know are associated with it. And one of the things that I did, for example, was that I looked at a survey called the Fragile Families and Child Wellbeing Survey that has nearly 10,000 people, and many of them, over 50% of them, are Medicaid beneficiaries. So I had lots of a sort of large sample to consider, and I looked at people who took that survey who were Medicaid beneficiaries and people who were not, but who were very similar to each other in many other ways. They were similar in terms of their level of poverty. They were similar in terms of their race, similar in terms of many aspects of their life circumstance. And what I found was that this relationship between Medicaid and not participating in politics as much, not voting and not engaging in other ways, you know, didn't go away, right, as a result of you know, the folks who were Medicaid beneficiaries when compared to their counterparts who were similar in many, many other ways were still less likely to vote, even though the only observable difference between them was being a Medicaid beneficiary. And then what I did was I started talking to a lot of Medicaid beneficiaries to try to figure out, why would this be? Is there something about Medicaid? And what they told me again and again in many different ways, and I talked to beneficiaries from across the country, is that their negative experiences with Medicaid did affect the way that they thought about government and politics and their willingness and desire to participate in politics. And one of the things that the kind of fragmented nature of Medicaid, like we've been talking about, that it's different in different places. Well, you know, Medicaid beneficiaries know this very well. They're the ones who told this to me and brought the sort of the theme of this book to light for me. because they'd talk about how, you know, their parents in other states or their brothers in other states on Medicaid had one thing and they had another. Or they talk about how much Medicaid changed over time, that 5 years ago they were able to get benefits that they couldn't get now. Or they talk about how they went across, they moved slightly across the border to a different state and figured out they couldn't get something that was hugely important, or that they thought about moving. And when they researched to make sure they'd be able to get life-saving benefits in other states, they found out they wouldn't. And this sends a really clear message. It sends a message that says your value is not, your value and your needs aren't anything that will be responded to on account of you being a member of this broader political community or a citizen of the country. It depends on what state you live in and on how that state feels like treating you. And sometimes it depends on what county you live in, what neighborhood you live in, the kind of experience you have with the program, the kind of access you have to hospitals, to doctors, to benefits. And this kind of motley mix of contingencies, people feel it in their everyday life. And they know what it means. They know that they're the kind of people who aren't guaranteed anything, who aren't protected, even for this most basic set of health benefits. And people read those messages, and they feed those messages into their calculations about whether they should bother taking part in the political system, whether their voices are important and will be heard and responded to. And for the most part, Medicaid beneficiaries don't believe that, although it's worth saying that that varies, that in states that are being generous to beneficiaries, where benefits are consistent and where bureaucracies are well-staffed so that people have positive experiences and where benefits are expanding, we know that participation is more likely to happen, political participation. And in states where those things aren't the case, participation is less likely to happen. So the story isn't that Medicaid makes people not participate in politics. The story is that the kind of experience that people have with the program, which depends on decisions that states and localities make, can affect our democracy, can affect whether the voices of those folks are heard.
Do we see a difference in their for those folks, particularly ones who are, states that are more or less generous, I guess. Do we see any distinction between their voting patterns in federal versus state elections?
So in the data I have, I couldn't distinguish between, for most of the data, I couldn't distinguish between federal and state elections. I could, however, distinguish between state and federal elections and local elections. And what I found is that, you know, the decreased likelihood to participate spans across all of those different kinds of elections. So it's not sort of limited to what's happening at the national level. So it's not as though people are thinking, well, my negative experience with Medicaid, I won't participate in national politics, right? You know, instead, it affects the way people think about politics across the board. Part of it is that some of what's going on is really local, and people are thinking about this in terms of both in terms of their states and in terms of, you know, the federal government, and sometimes even more local than that. And so it affects what people are doing across the board and even beyond voting, like even whether or not people will participate in a local political group or attend a local political meeting. Just even the basics of democratic engagement are sort of eroded when people are alienated from the government on account of experiences with getting a very basic benefit, which is healthcare, right? So a lot of people think, I'm not asking you to pay my bills or to give me food. I want to be able to go see a doctor. And if the government doesn't see me as important enough to provide that, then why would I be important enough to participate in politics and to think that that would matter at all, that anyone at any level of government would listen to my voice?
So, it's a little bit counterintuitive, but the more that you cut Medicaid, the less likely its recipients are going to respond politically in some ways, right? I mean, that's the message being sent to some of these. That answers the question why we have 14 states that don't have an expanded Medicaid.
Yeah, I mean, the research record on this is growing stronger every day. So there are a few studies that came out last year that showed that states that expanded Medicaid in the wake of the Affordable Care Act that people were more likely to vote immediately in the wake of the expansions, right? So we know that expansion boosts voting, and it boosts voting especially in places, for example, that have high concentrations of poor people. So we have reason to believe that the boost is coming from the very people who are getting the benefit. And the opposite is also true. When you retract benefits, when you take things away, people are less likely to vote. I show this in the book, and then I also have another paper I recently wrote with a colleague that will be published soon that looks at a specific case, looks at Tennessee, because they made huge cuts in the mid-2000s and kicked hundreds of thousands of people off of their Medicaid program pretty quickly and pretty quickly without much warning. So we look at the election before and the election right after to try to see if there'll be any differences that aren't accounted for by lots of other things that we can measure and control for. And what we find is in the wake of a big set of cuts, people are significantly, the aggregate voting rates are significantly lower, right? So, you know, there's more and more evidence in more and more forms, whether it's from talking to people about their experience or looking at different kinds of big quantitative data that shows that, yeah, people are less likely to vote when you take away their benefits. And we would hope for the opposite, that people see that they're losing something important to them and they get out there and they push back. And that they, and they punish their elected officials. And we think that's how democracy should work, that when you take things away from your constituents that harm them, that those constituents will push back and that that will end up harming you politically. But that's not the way that it appears to work when it comes to Medicaid. Part of the reason is because, you know, people get alienated. They get discouraged, right, and they get sent very specific messages that they then listen to.
Right. And this is part of a broader narrative, right? I mean, if you're poor, you deserve to be poor. You're irrelevant. And here is, we're going to cut your Medicaid just to remind you of all those things that we've been trying to signal to you for decades, if not longer.
Yeah.
And so how much do you think, well, I guess I have two questions about that, about your data. One is, how much do you think there have been politicians who are aware of this dynamic, if not, you know, so specifically in terms of a qualitative sense, but they had an intuition or they had anecdotal sort of evidence of this. A, how much do you think that is the case? B, are you worried that, you know, I'm running for governor in Kentucky? I know what I'm going to do. I'm running for reelect. The way for me to do that, cut benefits. That's going to work for me two different ways, right? It's going to suppress the vote in some areas, and it's going to probably, I'm going to get appreciation from people who don't like people of color, you know, getting, Medicaid phones or whatever it is that they think that they're getting. I mean, how much do you worry about those two dynamics? Obviously, the second one, you're an academic. I understand the mission is to bring out the truth, but I just wonder how much you think this information has been or will be weaponized.
I do worry about that. I think two things. I think the two questions are related. I don't think that to many sort of political folks, this is anything new, right? I think that there's an intuition about these sorts of things that comes from the clear evidence, right? That, for example, they could kick hundreds of thousands of people off Medicaid in Tennessee, and the next election, that governor stays in power, right? And so there's lots of evidence over time that people can take pretty kind of harsh turns against programs like Medicaid and not necessarily suffer many consequences politically. And so I think intuitively or in some way, a lot of elected officials probably suspect this, right?
Right.
I also think that the folks who want to take these benefits away would want to take them away, whether or not it was going to be a political bust or boon for them, right? So they're likely going to behave the same way, whether they know this or not. It may give them a little bit more glee knowing this.
Right.
But what I focus on more, and one of the things that I try to think about as I, when I think about who to take this research to and who to disseminate it to, is focus on the way we can use information like this for good, right?
Right.
I think for any research that is produced, there are people who can misuse it, who can weaponize it, and there are people who can use it for good. And I think part of what I try to do is think about, you know, what does this mean? There are organizations out there that that mobilize and support Medicaid beneficiaries. It's great for them to know this and to have a sense that one of the ways they can be supporting Medicaid beneficiaries is politically, right? Not just providing them with economic resources, but thinking about helping them register to vote and helping them to be aware of political issues. I've talked to, you know, and spoken with hospital associations, primary care providers, all sorts of folks who say, wow, we never thought about Medicaid in these political terms, and this shapes the way that we want to approach our patients or our clients going forward. So I try to think about who can use this for good to offset the efforts that are right. already going to be made to dampen these folks' voices, you know?
It seems to me the answer to how, what's interesting about this is that from an ideological perspective that, liberals want to create a safety net. Medicaid is an important liberal institution. It was the biggest accomplishment, it seems to me, the expansion of Medicaid was probably the single biggest achievement by the Obama administration, specifically within the context of the ACA. That Medicaid expansion was probably the most important part of it, although I think there's an argument about the patient protections, broadly speaking. But that is considered a liberal solution to this problem, right? We're going to have a we're gonna make sure that we have a safety net for people. But the efficacy of that safety net is inhibited by that perspective and not making it a universal program, right? Because the idea is almost like the way I hate to use this as an analogy, but it's the way they hid bad mortgages, right? Ones that had more risk, which is you put it in bigger tranches and it's harder to get at those. So if the idea is that, Medicaid was set up specifically as a separate program from Medicare so that you could cut it, really, right? And diminish the benefits for essentially people of color and more broadly people living in poverty. The idea is you make a universal program and those people are made safer, that the liberal the liberal agenda is more fulfilled with a more socialistic, for lack of a better word, universal program, right? I mean, this is the best argument for universal health care, it seems to me, in terms of the poor, because it protects that portion of the population as much, if not more, than any, because they're more susceptible to getting their benefits cut.
Yeah, I mean, this is a classic debate among people who are trying to figure out how to help the most needy with social policy. Do we target to them, which often is much more politically feasible because it's less costly, or do we try to create universal programs that cover everyone, which is more politically sustainable because you can't isolate the poor people's programs and try to, pick them off one by one. And it's a classic and difficult dilemma. You know, I think that a kind of universal approach to health policy is preferred, is better, and is, you know, it's a more sort of effective fulfillment of the kind of liberal vision. It's one way of thinking about it, but it should be a more a more effective and more compelling fulfillment of what should be everyone's vision for Americans to be able to be as healthy as possible on terms that are equitable. You know, a lot of people just don't realize that what state you live in, what race you are, how much money you make, these are things that will determine your access to benefits that essentially decide whether you could live or die. I don't actually think that even people who understand themselves, many at least, to be Republicans would say that that's right. Could actually think of a moral grounding for that sort of policy design. I can't fathom what the moral grounding is. There are kind of fiscal and practical grounds, right? Oh, we don't want to, spend this much money. But the moral grounds for the arbitrariness of the whole system, even for many people who are doing everything right and working hard, you just happen to live in the wrong state. And so I think that there's a liberal case to make. I think that there's a human case to make. And I focus on Medicaid in my research because Medicaid is the institution we have. And so let's think about how to make it the best we can. But, you know, in the sort of backdrop for me is always, let's think about how to build new institutions that are more inclusive, more equitable, and more politically and economically sustainable. And that will mean looking beyond Medicaid and looking to a universal system.
Jamila Mishner, the book is Fragmented: Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks.
Dave Rubin has been doing a lot of stuff since we've been gone, and we got to talk about him a little bit. Do we have the clip of did you pull the clip of him, the one where he was on the interview in Britain, and they played the clip of Anna?
I have that available if we want to
go to
that.
Okay, yeah, let's get that, too.
It's hilarious.
But there is a...
he hears the truth in real time.
There's a YouTube guy. Is this Timba on Toast? Is this the guy who does these?
Yep, Timba on Toast. T-I-M-B-A-H... And then dot on dot toast.
I would recommend people go and watch every one of these chapters, essentially, of Dave Rubin's Battle of Ideas. But this is a segment from Dave Rubin's Battle of Ideas, Part 3. And this involves Dave Rubin. Now, look, we played this clip, I think, last week before we left about Sam Harris. Sam Harris was talking about Tommy. What's that guy's name?
Robinson.
Tommy Robinson. Who was, if I'm not mistaken, was like arrested in Britain for hate speech. He's, how would you describe him?
In my opinion, I would assess him, in my view, as a far right, I would say fascist would be my
anti-Muslim
opinion.
Particularly.
Primarily an anti-Muslim activist and affiliated with UKIP and others and the English Defense League, which definitely has... and also a member of the British National Party. So, I mean, extreme far right.
And at the very least, we know the British perceive him to have been, guilty of something.
I believe incitement.
Incitement or something.
I think it was something to that effect.
Sam Harris... You know, is talking about, like, this guy seems perfectly reasonable to me. I only watched an hour-long video. I'm not from Britain. I only watched an hour-long video of him on Dave Rubin, but he seemed perfectly rational for an hour. As if, like, this is a huge accomplishment. As if there isn't an extraordinary amount of data and anecdata that shows that what extremists do is attempt to get into the mainstream, and they know they have to play to a more mainstream audience. And that's the way that they basically, you know, create their sales funnel. And Dave Rubin is the sales funnelist of the funnels when it comes to basically sending people down an alt-right rabbit hole. I mean, look, there is a dark web. And the things that happen on the dark web are credit card numbers and social security numbers get sold and racists hang out.
Child pornography.
Right. Okay. So the intellectual
good
dark
branding.
Web, it's that they think they're being ironic. But the fact is what they are is we're the ones who basically genetically mutate the dark web and bring it out into the open so that people can see it and follow it back down to its rabbit hole. And this is a perfect example of it. Dave Rubin either does no work about who he has on his guests, just looks at maybe whether they're popular within, alt-right and right-wing circles, or he ignores what he finds so that he doesn't have to deal with stuff that's unpalatable because he wants to sell this to a broader audience. Here is a perfect example of it, as narrated by Timba on Toast.
Well, it's parodying itself.
Wow. Well, listen, it's powerful stuff, and I love doing this because I think a lot of this, it flips conventional thinking on its head.
And whilst we're speaking about Sotomayor, there's another topic which might have been of interest to Dave's viewers, which Dave never brought up. And that is Tommy's controversial stance on Jewish people.
Pause it. Now, okay, recently, so he's talking about an interview that he did of this guy, Tommy Sotomayor, who is, I don't know, is he a YouTube guy or what? I don't exactly.
Yeah, apparently.
And this is going into Rubin's, you know, attacks on people for being anti-Semitic. Good for him. There's a lot of tweets that he's put out there. I'm sure it's been, if you updated it with like the Ilhan Omar things, he seems very offended. But here we go.
And that is Tommy's controversial stance on Jewish people. Recently, Dave has been fiercely cracking down on anti-Semitism on Twitter, dealing out some harsh criticism for those who he perceives to be displaying anti-Semitic attitudes. Well, you might say, if Dave thinks those people are bad, I can only imagine the hard-hitting questions he'll have for someone who has appeared in podcasts with former Grand Wizard of the KKK, David Duke, and denied the Holocaust.
We don't have to go back that far, Dr. Duke. We can go right now to Black Lives Matter. Who started it?
Jews.
You as a white man should want to push whites in America to become, to concentrate more on education, because Jews push that to their people. And then they push alcohol to your people and mine. They push drugs to your people and mine.
I want you guys to understand, Jews are financing black folks' genocide. This is what's happening. They're financing your genocide.
Now, I know what people are going to say. They're going to say, well, wait a minute, you can't say that because Jews and the Holocaust, and they didn't choose to be in the Holocaust. Yeah, they did. Mm-hmm. They were, the Jews did the same thing. They literally could have walked out of that situation and said, we don't want to do it. No. But that ain't what they said.
For some reason, although Dave never misses
Sean,
the
pause it. I got to.
I have an idea, Shlomo. How about we just walk out of here?
Let's,
there's an exit sign in the other direction. Maybe we could just leave.
Nah.
But then we won't be able to ply white and black people alcohol later. Oh, the dilemmas.
We're all going to gather around. One of us is going to survive, and it's going to be your job to sell the darkies and the whiteies, the booze and the pills.
They'll sell the booze. And your cousin, he's bookish. Eli, you write a whitey book about all this. The plan's in place.
Okay. So this is TJ Sotomayor, like a series of different videos.
It's very provocative ideas. Provocative ideas.
You know, big ideas.
I got to tell you, I mean, as someone who, not anymore, but was willing before the like mass incitement against her to say that years before she was a congresswoman, she could have phrased a tweet differently. I think this is quite a stark contrast to Ilhan Omar's ever ready commitment to say, I'm willing to learn and I condemn anti-Semitism.
Right.
For some reason, although Dave never misses the opportunity to go to bare knuckles on Twitter for anti-Semitism on the left, when he's in the presence of someone on the right who explicitly pushes anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial on a regular basis, he avoids the topic completely. During the hour-long interview, Dave never asks Sotomayor a single question about this.
Wow.
And there's one more thing which I want to show you before
Pause.
We move
that
on.
Is that, now, just contemplate this. That's, I mean, I don't know. Maybe those are the only, maybe those two different interviews he did with David Duke and that one time on his video, he, you know, said the Holocaust was basically an opt-in situation for Jews. Maybe, you know, Dave didn't know about them and did. Maybe there was just no way to find that. Like, I don't even know who TJ Sotomayor is, but of course, I'm not inviting him on the show.
Right.
And, you know, we don't do extensive, like, online research of our guests. Now, we have 4 to 5 times more guests a week, I think, than Dave does. One would think that that would come up in some of your research. What do you think about the Jews? But apparently, even though Dave is such a huge fighter against anti-Semitism, not that much of an issue, doesn't want to scare anybody. I don't want to get into that big idea.
Well, as Tim Bontois points out later in the video, Dave is self-consciously having conversations with quote-unquote controversial people, but never does any sort of look into what is controversial about these people.
Right. Right.
I wasn't
it's the
really
dark
interested.
Web. You can't say this stuff anywhere else. Well, why don't you ask him why? Why can't you say that stuff? Who's preventing you from going out there and saying on YouTube, like, you know, Holocaust denialism? But it gets even better. I wonder if Dave brought up any other things that maybe this guy has an issue with.
This. And there's one more thing which I want to show you before we move on. Foreshadowing this interview with Tommy Sotomayor, Dave delivers a monologue about how open-minded conservatives are compared to the left, and highlights their acceptance of LGBTQ rights.
Do you know people on the right who are tolerant of people who are for gay marriage and who are pro-choice? I actually do, plenty of them, including several people who I've had on this show. When there is a disagreement, I see way more people on the right, conservatives or libertarians, more often willing to agree to disagree rather than to defriend or to smear. Let's not forget, even Donald Trump got a standing ovation at the Republican National Convention when he talked about protecting LGBTQ rights.
This is ironic.
Pause
because it.
That was a great standing ovation that he got. Transgender people now barred from the military. Just today, we had more attacks on transgender folks' rights. But as long as he got a clap for it. But go ahead.
He talked about protecting LGBTQ rights.
This is ironic because, as it turns out, Dave's conservative guest of that episode, Tommy Sotomayor, didn't actually know that Dave was gay. On a live stream months after the interview, one of Sotomayor's fans broke the news to him, and here's how he reacted.
Steven said, they hate Dave Rubin because he's a gay man with the wrong opinion. Dave Rubin is gay? No! He got a husband? I did not know. I was in his presence. I didn't know. I shook his hand. Ah! I sat down with him. Why didn't y'all tell me before I went on the show? Oh, Steven, why would you send me this? Oh my God, Steven, you ruined my day.
Maybe this guy Sotomayor's anti-gay feelings never came up. That was the first time maybe that people were aware that he was anti-gay.
I'm just more interested in talking about ideas.
I mean, your reaction really fascinates me. Can we talk about that?
You said you want to wash
your hand. Like, what is it?
What does that mean?
What are you implying about?
You know, it's really, I don't know if we're going to play the fuller clip, though, where basically the guy was on to, like, trash the black family, like, literally, like, 1960s style, like, conservative tripe nonsense. So that is what Dave's interested in. He's not interested in the Holocaust stuff. He's not interested in the homophobia stuff. But the core brand proposition of trashing black people.
I would also add, circling back to Donald Trump's gotten applause for protecting LGBTQ rights. In addition to the transgender ban in the military, Trump administration is planning to roll back protections for transgender patients while empowering healthcare workers to refuse care based on religious objections. This is according to three officials with knowledge of the pending regulations. And then this isn't necessarily included, I guess. He didn't get applause for this. But the Trump administration was asked by to pass a UN resolution to end sexual violence in war. Apparently, the United States said no. We're not going to do that. They passed a watered-down version diluted by the Trump administration because you don't want to get overly uptight about sexual violence during war.
Where does it end?
It's a slippery slope. It's a slippery slope. You start doing it in war, and then all of a sudden you're going to be doing in domestic in peace.
This is civilian life.
Civilian. Oh, okay, so Mehdi Hasan was the example of the journalist who was doing quality work. Let's go over to Fox and Friends. And this is going to be the most meaningless piece of video that we show you today. But it is just too funny to watch the Fox and Friends try and get out there and do a nanny state piece. This is where, you know, of course, somebody wants to tell you not to text when you're crossing the street because you could get hit by a car or run into somebody. Now, this
is
a
true
huge problem, particularly in New York City. I imagine it's a problem in other cities, but it's a huge problem here. Like, one, I mean, just
walking, but like people running into bikes, people getting hit by cars. I mean, this is a huge problem. And like literally, if I had a, if there was a, like an RFID chip or something I could implant in my daughter's hands so that when she was to step off a curb, it would like make her fingers freeze, I would do it.
It's another
but
de Blasio
here
failure.
Is Steve Ducey trying to do a segment on the nanny state, and it turns out he's, I can't believe it. This is not one of those things that they're going to do again live. Yeah, let's put it that way.
He might be discovering that there is a problem with people not paying attention to anything besides their
phone. Yeah, exactly. Here we go.
We've been watching all sorts of people walking by with their texting device. Excuse me, ma'am. Hello? Hello? Excuse me? Hi? Can I ask a question? It'll just take a second.
Okay.
I see you're walking through the crosswalk with your phone.
Yeah.
How often do you look at your phone with a text and things like that?
I try not to often.
You may be, going forward, you could get fined $250. Is that a bad idea or a good idea?
I really don't want to.
Okay. I don't think she has. She's in a hurry to go to work. Okay, this guy right over here. Hi, how are you? Looking at this guy right here. See, he's using his phone through. Hi, excuse me. Can I ask a question? Can you tell that New York City is a very busy place? It is indeed. All right. Meanwhile, we got all these people. They're going to work. Keep in mind, if you're working in New York City at 9 o'clock, you got 20 minutes to go.
Right.
And so everybody's in a big hurry. Now, right over here, AJ,
note to producer, don't do these segments at this time. Here we go.
See if I can get his attention. Excuse me. Excuse me, sir. Hi. Excuse me? Can I ask you a question? Come on, let's go across the street.
Oh, I'm going to get hit by a car!
Now, all the people who are texting or looking at their phones could be subject to a $250 fine going forward.
Yeah, yeah.
But it looks as if, so far, from the people on the streets of New York City, let's just talk to this guy. Hi, excuse me, can I ask you a question? Everybody.
What's the fine for harassing commuters?
Oh, my God. No kidding.
Again, no one wants to talk to Ducey. No one. I love it.
Ducey on the Lucy.
He's getting treated. And by the way, you shouldn't be mean to people trying to raise money for Amnesty International on the street. It's a nightmare job. Be nice to them and move by them quickly. But they are giving him you're trying to raise money for Amnesty International on the street treatment.
Honestly.
There isn't even like a, it's TV. None of the, it's just like, nope.
Yeah,
nope,
I mean,
nope.
If you see someone like Steve Ducey coming up to you, it's perfectly okay to go like, no, stop.
Oh, yes. If it's Ducey, do that.
Stand back.
Or go, you're aptly named. Have a good day.
I mean, the beauty of them trying to build this sort of nanny state segment around it, like where people, these people are really pissed at the idea that someone would tell them what to do. Oh, I'm sorry. Could you stop for 1 second? I need to
interrupt
your day. They can't decide because they've also done segments on how sad it is that everyone is always on their phones.
Right. Well,
it's
teens.
It's okay when they do
teens.
It.
And They'll do a 45-minute segment a while back on teenagers who wear their pants too low. But the idea that you would actually impose some type of restriction on texting as you're walking through a street is highly problematic to them. And incidentally, you know, we look at things like Vision Zero in this city, which was much maligned. But I can tell you right now, from my perspective, that people drive slower. They drive slower in New York City than they did 3 years ago. And
why was it maligned? I mean, I'm not a de Blasio fan, but I don't understand.
Oh, it was
problem.
Much maligned.
Safety project?
What was it again? Just because it was...
You're
going to
make us drive 25 miles
right.
an hour? It's crazy. It's so hostile to cars.
Right. That's a good thing.
It's
you
a
should
good,
be hostile to cars. Cars
but,
are bad.
But,
cars
you,
are
but you know, this is the way this trajectory... I mean, I don't know if you guys are too young to remember like the huge, huge national issue. Not smoking in restaurants was even bigger, but buckling your seatbelt. When those
disgusting.
Laws got passed, Morton Downey Jr., who was the original like Rush Limbaugh character, he would do... show after show on the infringement, the nanny state, making you buckle your seatbelts.
My grandma was affected by that. She had bad dreams about that she'd be in a car crash and wouldn't be able to get out because the seatbelts.
Right, that's what they were telling.
Because what happens is you get trapped by the seatbelt and then you can't get out, and it's a very bad thing. There's a lot of people, they might feel a little scared. They were crashed, but then they can step outside. But then when you can't, then you die.
And remember, I mean, the cigarettes, smoking, nobody, I mean, you don't hear anybody complain about that now. It's absurd when you go into a place. Only in Vegas is the only place you see people smoke inside.
Sean got very excited when we were in Miami and you could smoke in a bar.
Oh, well, there you go. And remember the 30 ounce slushies that became outlawed or whatever it was?
Oh, I was against that.
Yeah, the soda ban. I'd like to see the data now to see if that's had an impact, a positive impact or a negative one on some economic standpoint. Somebody must have done some research now.
Is that why sodas are 20 ounces here and not 24? Because I remember them being 24 in North Dakota.
I think so.
Soda sommelier.
Let's go to the phone. Let's just play this Joe Rogan thing. It's pretty funny. And then we will go into the fun half. Apparently, David Pakman was on the Joe Rogan show sometime in the past couple of days, and they were talking about the demonetizing of Steven Crowder. And, you know, we'll have more to talk about this in the fun half because, you know, to me, just the idea that this is censorship is just absurd, particularly in Steven Crowder's case. You know, I mean, I suppose theoretically, if there are people who are only relying on you. When you demonetize somebody, suppose if you deplatform somebody, you could say that they're being censored in some fashion. But to demonetize, to me, doesn't seem that way at all. But here is Joe Rogan asking if harassing Carlos Maza has an equivalency on the left. And I will say this, that the harassment of Carlos Maza, I think, has been overstated as a reason for YouTube's action. I think it's just the general gay bashing, which has been problematic. Michael yesterday read the terms of service of YouTube. And, you know, there are protected classes of people. In our society, their protections are only not as individuals, but as classes of people. So, you know, let's use this as a jumping off point. Here is David Pakman with Joe Rogan.
Is that different, in your opinion, than someone singling something out for what you believe is their mental incompetency?
Well, the mental incompetent. Do you mean that they're ignorant, or that they're mentally ill, or cognitively limited?
Cognitively limited, mocking their ability to think, mocking their intelligence, mocking their decisions, mocking the way they talk, and then encouraging other people to do the same thing, and then that person gets harassed based on their intelligence, based on their performance on particular YouTube videos and conversations. And there's active harassers. There's people that do that. Is there a difference between, say, what Sam Cedar does to Dave Rubin?
What does Sam do to Dave Rubin?
He has.
I don't know that I've seen that video.
Dozens of videos. Don't say that video. He has dozens of videos where he's just dunking on Dave Rubin.
So, I have some as well. I believe that they are substantive. That's my view, is that my videos about Dave Rubin are substantive. Mm-hmm. I don't really watch any left-wing stuff because I want to try to isolate myself enough to make sure that what I'm saying are my ideas and that I'm not taking them. So I don't, Sam's a friend of mine.
Sounds like a comic.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Comics do that.
I don't know, but if there are some specific examples, we could comment about them. But I think that to your first question, there is a difference between going after someone for sexual orientation.
Right.
Then going after them for the fact that they say things that are wrong or don't know stuff, until you're making fun of someone who has an actual handicap of some kind of, cognitive limitation that would be a disability of some kind. Then you are mocking someone for a disability.
But the resulting effect of the harassment, see, this is what I was getting at before with Crowder. Like, what Crowder said was one thing, but one of the things that Carlos Mesa was just discussing was what the people that had watched Crowder, what they were doing, how they were going after.
All right. Well, I mean, you know,
raises some serious questions about our ethical responsibilities if Dave Rubin is indeed a touched individual.
Well, yeah, and I don't think that Dave Rubin is, you know, has any type of particular limitations beyond what appears to be a lack of research or reasoning or thoughtfulness about what he does.
Now, sounds like a limitation.
Let me just address a couple of things. One, it's true. We do have dozens of videos dunking on Dave Rubin, but it is not because Dave Rubin is anything other than a commentator who is saying stuff that is nonsensical. I don't criticize Dave Rubin for anything other than either misrepresenting the truth, being completely unknowledgeable, but fairly, but very confident about putting out opinions about stuff, misrepresenting his positions, and for laundering people who have really horrible, detrimental effects on society. The idea that Dave Rubin is harassed online, I'm not worried about Maza being harassed online. People get harassed online all the time. I'm not even like worried about the doxing insofar as it relates to Steven Crowder, because Steven Crowder, to my, at least as far as I know, has not called for him to be doxed. I think that would be irresponsible. The problem with what Crowder has done is by, and I think, you know, basically I said this the other day, before Rogan had made this point. When you are attacking someone based on the fact that they're gay or that they're of a certain ethnicity or a color or religion, whatever it is,
disability.
Gender, disability, you are poisoning society in a way that has implications for hundreds of thousands, sometimes in millions of people. You are impacting the structure of society. By criticizing and dunking on Dave Rubin because he keeps saying things that are not bright on YouTube or are demonstrably wrong or are demonstrably misinformed or are demonstrable misrepresentations does not have the societal implications. Well, I don't care if people call me names. And,
well, and also I just want to really underline it too, that even if Crowder did a bunch of videos saying, I think Carlos Mesa's dumb and I'm going to refute his points and make fun of him and do an offensive impression, that is still, first of all, that would not be an issue. And it is
perfectly
not what he's
legitimate.
Doing that got him on the radar.
Well,
yeah,
according
not.
To Joe Rogan,
it's not.
We are being ableist towards Dave Rubin.
Well, that's the thing I do want to say is I think Joe is opening up, especially for those of us in the studio who are more worried about these things, a very concerning point, which I have thought of from time to time myself, which is that if Dave has a real limitation, I'd like him to publicly say that. I will certainly change up at least my programming.
But we're not, if you're saying that he has some type of disability, but I don't think that, I mean, maybe he does.
That's what I'm saying is I don't know. Is. That was never articulated in that way in terms of Dave before. And I mean, I don't want to, that would put a whole different paint job on it for me.
I believe the phrase Joe Rogan used was cognitively limited.
If Dave Rubin is cognitively limited, then I will do a slightly different impression.
Maybe we have, in passing, said that he's cognitively limited, in reference to explain what he said. And maybe that is going a little too far. We could just simply say that he's just horribly, horribly ignorant to the issues, which I think is actually in many respects, and I've made this clear, I think, even more reprehensible. Because you have a responsibility, in my mind, if you're going to go on with, whatever he has, a million followers on YouTube, you've got to do your homework, and you have a responsibility. But that's the way I feel about that.
Yeah, and to be clear, the issue is the specific incitement around the specific category. Not mocking somebody, not making fun of them, not debunking them, not being mean, not being satiric, not having people tweet at them or whatever. It's the specific use. And again, even according in an incredibly strict sense, and I know we'll talk about it more later, but huge miscalculation by YouTube. They had a case, which is all Carlos Massa asked for, on one person who in fact violated their own written terms of service, which you agree to these stupid things when you set up a channel. That's it. There's actually should be really nothing more to it as of this case.
Right. All right.